Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, the big business of hospice.
One investor recently put it at a conference, hospice is the hottest thing going.
The movement came to the U.S. in the late 60s, promising comfort and compassion at the end of life. Today, half of all Americans die in hospice care, and what was once a sector run by not-for-profit organizations has become a booming industry, one that some experts say too often prioritizes profit over patients. In this week's New Yorker, ProPublica's Ava Kaufman traces how this happened. She points to lax regulations and a Medicare payment system that can easily be exploited by companies looking to make a buck. Ava, you start your piece with a woman named Marcia Farmer. Tell us who she is and why she's so important to this story about hospice.
Marcia Farmer is a very courageous former hospice employee who began in the industry in 2002. She was working in a kind of mid-sized chain in southern Alabama and had previously done sales and worked, doing sales in healthcare. And when she first came to hospice, to her, it kind of appeared more like a calling than a sales gig. And this is something I heard throughout my reporting. Former hospice employees say that, you know, there's nothing quite like this kind of work. You only get into it kind of for the right reasons because it's so intimate. It's so, unglamorous even compared to the rest of healthcare. And it's so important. You have to really believe in this, humane and patient-centered mission to really want to kind of spend time doing hospice work. And so Marcia was just completely drawn, being able to, spread the gospel of hospice, so to speak, in her community to help more people access this benefit of end-of-life care. And over time, as her company grew bigger, it got acquired by a large nursing home chain, which was in turn acquired by a large private equity firm. She started to feel more and more pressure to bring in patients. And the pressure to bring in patients started to make her feel like the patients themselves weren't really that important. She could have been dealing, I think she told me at one point, with cars or chairs or ice cream. It became all about the numbers, she said. And when it becomes all about the numbers in hospice, and this has come up, throughout, frankly, over 100 lawsuits across the country against major hospice chains, when it becomes all about the numbers, you stop necessarily selling hospice to patients who actually need it. And instead, you're bringing in people who may not actually be dying.
I think before we go on, it would be good to describe what hospice is, what it's supposed to be, and how it began.
So people have been taking care of dying people in, all sorts of ways, obviously, throughout history. And the modern hospice movement, as we know it and describe it, gets its start in the 1960s, which is, obviously a time of great social ferment, across women's health movements and the mental health movement, and rights to die with dignity also become a kind of chief demand of people who are looking at the medical system and wanting it to do more to treat people as actual people. At the time, a lot of doctors and nurses are noticing that dying people are kind of ignored at worst and at best, although not always to their advantage, overtreated, cared for in ways that actually do more harm than good when there's nothing more to be done for their prognosis. And a doctor named Cicely Saunders in the UK sees this unnecessary suffering all around her and starts to wonder if some of the really strong pain medications that are used to help people with surgeries and help people all kinds of things can be used to help dying people suffer less and spend more time with their families and exit the world, you know, as gracefully and as, you know, in their own control as possible, as humanely possible.
So that means a patient could perhaps be brought home and be given certain amounts of care, all provided by Medicare. Isn't that correct?
Yeah. So fast forward 10 years and her vision becomes, you know, something that President Reagan signs into a Medicare benefit, helping at first, you know, a small amount of Americans, and now half of all Americans die on hospice care. And so when done right, you're able to access, you know, exactly what Cicely Saunders and her followers envisioned. Regular nursing visits, social worker, bereavement counselors, clergy of all denominations, and home aides who can help with bathing and medications. It's a really holistic and often bespoke vision of healthcare, and we don't really see anything like it anywhere else in the healthcare system.
Explain the difference between what you're talking about here, which is basically home hospice care or nursing home care. Explain the difference between that hospice care and what happens within a hospital, which designates a certain area of the hospital for hospice care. The two are very different, I think.
They can be different. Often if you're in a hospital receiving with an inpatient hospice care, it usually just means that you're getting an even higher level of care. So home hospice care is the most common because it has, for many different reasons. I mean, a lot of people want to be in their homes and stay in their homes. There's also lower overhead for the hospice companies. So actually only 20% of all hospice companies in the United States even have inpatient facilities that they could take their patients to. So there's, you know, inpatient care, which you can receive at a hospital. It's more common at a nursing home or in an inpatient hospice facility. You can receive home care. You can receive intensive home care called respite care. So there's several different levels of hospice, and companies, you know, who are doing right by their patients provide them all and try to adjust depending, you know, on how much you need and how great the need is.
Isn't there also tighter regulation as to who receives hospice care within a hospital setting than there might be with someone who receives or is encouraged to receive home hospice care or a building assigned to hospice care?
And I think what you're getting at is that when hospice care takes place in the home, you know, it's happening essentially out of sight and behind closed doors. And so just like having a home health aide or anything really that takes place in your own home, it's much more difficult to have any sort of standardization in terms of, you know, regulations or oversight. And because hospice, as it's currently designed, you know, I think there's really huge pros and cons. You have this benefit that allows it to be customized with a plan of care for what each patient needs. So a certain patient might need a nurse to come 5 times a week, and another one only needs someone to come by, you know, 30 minutes a week. But that can obviously lead to a slippery slope in some cases where you have a patient who really could use a lot of nursing care. You know, their families are pushed to the brink with, you know, round-the-clock toileting and medication and feeding needs. All of these things become very, very complicated towards the end of life. And because the hospice doesn't have a strict requirement, they might still only be coming by 30 minutes a week, or they might just be providing telephonic support. And so I think the one thing, Diane, people don't realize is that often in hospice, even under the best of circumstances with the most well-meaning providers, you know, 95 to 99% of the care is still being provided by the family.
The other element that a hospice provides is the equipment that comes with hospice care. My husband, my late husband, was in a nursing home. He died of Parkinson's disease, and His doctor declared he was within 6 months of death. So immediately on the announcement that he was within 6 months of death, hospice came in with a brand new bed and with services, some of which were welcome and some of which seemed almost unnecessary. And I'm just wondering about all that expense, which comes at taxpayer, from taxpayer dollars.
Yeah, I mean, the equipment that's provided by hospices, I mean, what I found in my reporting is, you know, whether or not someone even has 6 months or less to live, it's often really needed. Because, you know, if you are someone who's chronically disabled or sick, or nearing the end of your life, whether it's a couple years away or 3 weeks away, that kind of specialized equipment is incredibly helpful. I mean, it seems like the main kind of waste, as you're saying, of taxpayer dollars comes when people who, you know, are, you know, 35 years old or, you know, 51 and, you know, just recovered are getting signed up fraudulently for hospices. And so what I found, where I found the really kind of egregious fraud and abuse of this vital Medicare benefit taking place was in hospices that were just signing up patients essentially willy-nilly without their knowledge.
And how did they do that without their knowledge?
That's a great question. So there's a couple different ways of doing it. Often what some of the former marketers told me is that they would tell people, yes, you know, have you heard of hospice maybe? And the person would say, yeah, but isn't that for people who are dying? And they say, no, it's not like that anymore. It's just home health. It's just a great government service. Hospice isn't what it used to be. And so there's all of these ways that you can get someone to sign a piece of paper because you're, you know, offering services to them that they may or may not need for free. And in that sense, you know, the hospice fraud schemes are not that different from what we've heard or seen with, you know, when it comes to durable medical equipment or all these other different pharma scams that, you know, proliferate and have proliferated.
So, Marcia Farmer, back to where we began, what did she do that really focused on what these corporations were actually receiving?
Yeah, so Marcia had always felt, I think, she became increasingly uncomfortable at her job. She worked for a large hospice corporation, was asked to bring in patients, felt like she was being pressured to bring in patients regardless of whether or not they were eligible for the service. Some of her patients and the patients that her, you know, nurses cared for on the service fished or drove tractors or dined out at Wendy's or babysat grandchildren. And I'm sure you know from your own hospice experience with your late husband, those are not the kinds of things that someone near the end of life is typically able to do.
Hardly.
So, you know, it's almost darkly, you know, comic in this way. But yeah, I mean, so she has these patients who are, you know, nowhere near death, but who are, you know, being provided with, again, as you said, all this expensive equipment, supplies, and who the companies are able to bill Medicare this flat daily rate for each day, which is why this is happening. There's a very incentivizing profit motive for those who wish to take advantage of it. And as she sees this happening around her, she learns that a few other nurses have blown the whistle at a similar hospice company, a competitor, and realizes that what her company is doing might not just be uncomfortable or unethical or make her uneasy, but that she's not the only one who sees that this is wrong. And that in fact, this behavior might not just be wrong, but it actually might also be a violation of the law. They might be defrauding Medicare by submitting these false claims. And so she teams up with another really courageous colleague of hers, and they end up blowing the whistle on this company.
And to whom do they blow the whistle, and what happens?
So they end up filing a suit in 2009 in the Northern District of Alabama. accusing AseraCare, the company that she works at, and Golden Living, which at the time is one of the largest nursing home chains in the world, on the planet actually, of Medicare fraud. And that lawsuit goes on to become one of the most pivotal and consequential and frankly bizarre legal battles in the history of hospice care. And they're using this little known act, at least little known to me at the time, although widely used, called the False Claims Act, which allows any citizen, you know, deputizes, essentially privatizes the function of, you know, being a kind of government watchdog. And if you see a company that's you think is defrauding Medicare or defrauding some other government program, this applies to medical companies, it can apply to defense contractors, and so on, you actually have the right to sue them and recover part of the monies that the government has lost. So it's a really interesting law, the False Claims Act. And Marcia and her colleague at work teamed up to use it to see if they might be able to hold their company, whom they believed was committing fraud, accountable under this law.
And how far did they get?
So they got somewhere quite interesting, which is that most of these lawsuits, most False Claims Act lawsuits, never go to trial. Trials are quite rare because they cost often way more than what the settlement amount with the government would cost. So, and they have a much higher risk. You can get banned from contracting with Medicare if you go to trial. And if you work in healthcare, that's, you know, tantamount to the death penalty for your business. So this case, in an unusual turn of events, ends up going to trial. And the jury at the trial decides that, you know, most of the claims that the government has identified as false claims that AseraCare has submitted to them are such that, you know, the jury decides that it seems like, you know, over 86% of these claims for hospice, these patients were not eligible for some or all of the periods.
86%? Wow.
And this is not of all of the claims, I should specify. The government takes a small random statistical sample because it's impossible to review. So there's no evidence or knowledge really on, you know, the overall amount of claims. But for the small, very small sample that they're looking at, the jury rules overwhelmingly in the government's favor.
In the government's favor. So what happened to the corporation?
So what ends up happening, though, is that the judge on the case decides that the jury's verdict is not necessarily meeting the standard of the law as she understands it. And this is where it gets really complicated. So, I mean, when you make a claim for hospice, you're not making a diagnosis. You're making a prognosis. You're predicting that if this person's terminal illness runs its expected course, this person's going to have less than 6 months to live. And that's inherently, obviously, an uncertain determination. And there are levels of certainty you can have. You can say, I'm 95% sure this person has less than 6 months to live, or I'm 5% sure. But CMS, that is Medicare, doesn't require you to have a certain level of certainty. It just requires you to make a good faith judgment as a doctor and assume that, you know, most doctors will do so. And so what's really tricky about these cases and really tricky about holding companies to account is that under the legal theory as it's currently working, a lot of government prosecutors are kind of making this case that, you know, the doctor was kind of making a bad faith judgment at the time and certifying ineligible patients. But when you look at the actual certification, I mean, it's fair as a doctor to say, well, I would have no way of knowing that at the time this person was going to live longer than I thought they would. And so you can see how this gets, you know, it gets into a kind of second guessing territory that's quite, it's quite thorny. And you can make, you know, broader statistical claims like, well, if 90% of the patients who you certified, you know, went on to live for 2 years, that says something about the nature of your certifications. But when you're just looking claim by claim, you know, who's to say that someone's prediction, you know, was made in bad faith or made to be untrue or false at the time that they made it? So it becomes quite philosophical.
It's so interesting because right here in Washington, at what was the Washington Home and Hospice. A very famous patient, Art Buchwald, was in that home. And after 1 year in that home, they asked him to leave. He went home and he lived for yet another year. But what about the kinds of claims that Marcia Farmer brought forward about being pressured to bring patients into hospice? Was that part of the evidence?
So that's another really great question. Usually that would have been part of the evidence because it's a part of the pattern and practices that a business is conducting. But in this case, the case was separated into two parts. So the jury was only allowed to see evidence in the first part of the case, just looking at the false claims. It was a somewhat certainly unprecedented and somewhat controversial decision to make the jury just look at the claims in isolation from the business practices, the conditions, and the context in which they were produced. So a lot of what I learned and saw and read about in the court documents in terms of kind of how some of these sales pressures worked, how people were given bonuses to bring in patients, how they were rewarded with treats like popcorn machines and massage chairs and movie tickets, all of that wasn't actually brought into the first phase of the trial. And so one thing that Marcia Farmer told me is that, you know, she felt like she wasn't able to actually tell the full story. Nonetheless, the jury still ruled in this, you know, initial phase in the government's favor, which I think came as a surprise, you know, to everyone, given how kind of circumscribed the evidence had been under this legal theory.
So all of this is obviously not how a hospice is supposed to work. And did you find companies where it works quite well and works very fairly? Or is your article kind of a warning about how you can be coerced without your knowledge into a system that basically is not legit?
I think it's both. I think ideally I'm hoping that people read this story and are able to do their homework and do some research and make sure that when they're choosing a provider, I mean, hospice is so important. And so the last thing I'd want is, you know, for someone to read this article and say, well, you know, I'm throwing out the baby with the bathwater, to use a, you know, very tired cliche. And what I've heard from readers and what I hope is coming across is instead, you know, when it's time to use this service, and there will be a time either for you or for one of your family members, make sure to research, you know, does this hospice have a good rate of visits? Does this hospice have a high number of substantiated complaints? How do the hospice's financials work? Does this hospice use bereavement coordinators? And do they follow up with the families after the fact? Or are they cutting corners there? You know, is this hospice owned by a private equity company? And, you know, if so, what's their track record of, you know, staffing and paying their staff fairly? And obviously that requires work and time. And when you're stressed out and overwhelmed and more to the point, sick, or have a family member or loved one who's sick, that might not just be time that you have. But there are a few more, you know, transparency tools coming online. And there are, you know, families who've written to me and said, you know, now I'm just going to research this hospice and make sure. And so I think and hope that's the takeaway and message. I mean, even the families I spoke to who had these horrific stories, you know, nightmarish experiences, said, you know, I want to make sure this doesn't happen to anyone again. But at the same time, you know, I know that hospice is important, and I just want to make sure that people do their homework.
Now, a quick break. Hi, it's Diane. Join me for my next book club event, a conversation with Sheila Johnson. She's co-founder of BET, all about her memoir, Walk Through Fire. That's coming up Wednesday, April 24th at 6 p.m. Eastern. Find out more. Register at dianeween.org/book club. And we're back. Here's the rest of my conversation with ProPublica's Ava Kaufman. Her story, Endgame, appears in the December 5th issue of The New Yorker. Ava, what kind of harm can actually occur to patients if there's a move into hospice?
Well, I guess it would depend. I mean, if they need hospice, some of the harms that can occur to someone who needs hospice but is getting poor hospice care, I mean, the most common one is just inadequate pain management. So if you're put on a hospice and you're in a lot of pain and you're expecting that hospice to help you with the pain, or you were receiving, you know, special pain medications from your oncologist and now your relationship with them might have, you know, gotten broken because you moved on to hospice, and you just might not be getting the pain care you need if you're in a hospice that's cutting corners. Of course, there's lots of hospices that, you know, don't cut corners and will give you that pain management, but that's the big concern for people who need hospice. Now, if you're someone who's moved on to hospice and it's not the right time, you're not even terminally ill, you might have some conditions like COPD or diabetes, or, you know, might be chronically sick, have heart failure, but, you know, you're still doing well. Hospice can be actually quite harmful because you're losing access to curative treatments like your heart stabilizing medications. You could be denied dialysis. You could be denied preventative screenings that you might need to keep, you know, living a healthy life.
And what about cancer? If one has cancer and is being treated for cancer with, say, radiation or chemotherapy, and is moved from that into hospice, perhaps too soon, what happens then?
So some hospices are able to provide things like palliative radiation to help with the pain of cancer. Others don't cover it. I mean, the main thing that it seems like all experts agree on, and that, you know, all hospices and all of the wonderful hospices providers I spoke to really want to provide, is a wider range of services. So people don't have to make this terrible choice of, you know, cure versus care. And they can get both cure for their cancer, treatment for their cancer or curative-like treatments, and palliative care at the same time that treats their pain. And right now, the way that the hospice benefit is designed creates this dichotomy where you have to choose, all right, am I foregoing things like chemo and just going to focus on comfort care? Or am I going to stay with these really aggressive treatments that, you know, in some cases, you know, might have very marginal success rates until the bitter end, essentially, and end up on hospice, you know, far too late? I mean, one of the main things and main regrets that people have is that when they get to hospice and it is done right, they say, wow, I wish I'd come here sooner. I mean, this is such a amazing program. And, you know, all of a sudden I'm not in horrible pain every day. And so if we could design a program or have more funding for programs that allow people to access that benefit upstream, so to speak, I think that would make a huge difference in the lives of millions of Americans.
How widespread is hospice today in this country? How much of it controlled by money makers, money managers, and how much controlled by people within the medical field itself?
Yeah, that's a great question. So half of all Americans die on hospice. So it's almost 2 million people a year. And there are about 5,000 hospices in the U.S. today. 70% of those hospices are for-profit, is a large switch from the roots that we were talking about earlier in our conversation, when hospice started out essentially as a charity movement, mostly grassroots and staffed by volunteers. Recently, private equity and private equity acquisitions have tripled in the hospice space. I don't have an exact number on how many of the 70% of for-profit hospices are owned by private equity.
So whether you have an exact number or not, it has become a huge business, which is not how it began.
Absolutely. As one investor recently put it at a conference, hospice is the hottest thing going. So that's not a sentence I think that anyone who founded a hospice and had this kind of initial vision would have ever expected to hear, the word hospice and, you know, hottest and investment in the same sentence. Almost
exactly.
Sounds like an oxymoron.
And how difficult is it to police hospice?
I think it is difficult. I mean, it's inherently a difficult sector to police just because of what it's providing, which is care at the end of life. And, you know, it's really, even under the best of circumstances, you know, a lot of people would say that their loved one might not have had a good death. I mean, that's a difficult thing to adjudicate, and there aren't clear standards for what that looks like. It's an inherently often painful and upsetting process. So, you know, I think that does just kind of complicate how we can measure the quality of care that's being delivered. At the same time, there are so much more quality of care measures and metrics that can be brought to bear to measure patient and family satisfaction and to regulate and inspect hospices at a much more frequent basis. And as you pointed out earlier in our conversation, we have a system right now where anyone can open a hospice. And some of the elder care researchers and experts I've spoken to have wondered if that should be the case.
Huh. You found some pretty awful situations in your research where you have for-profit players enlisting patients, luring them with basically false premise and false promise, both of which are certainly harmful to the patient. Is there government oversight in what's happening?
There's not enough. And one of the only tools we have, which is the False Claims Act, which I was describing a few minutes earlier, you know, is basically asking whistleblowers to give up their jobs and livelihoods to root this out. And that to me was just, you know, it's certainly one really important tool, but to be the primary defense, you know, as one whistleblower attorney put it to me, that's a ludicrous amount of optimism in a system with a socialist payer and a capitalist payee to rely on, you know, individual nurses and their integrity and having them risk everything to ferret out wrongdoing. And so there needs to be, much stricter enforcement and frankly, attention to, you know, hospices that are paying bounties to bring in patients. California recently made it extra clear, if it wasn't already, that you shouldn't be able to pay recruiters to bring in hospice patients. So that was a new law that was passed in California. But I think it goes without saying that, you know, that should be something that should be made even more explicit across the country, if it already isn't.
And in the end, with the case that Marsha Farmer brought in, what happened to that company? Were they forced to pay?
The case ends up getting tossed out, essentially. The summary judgment is granted in favor of the company because the judge explains that the government doesn't have enough evidence of falsity besides its analysis of these medical records. And it becomes this kind of watershed or landmark moment in kind of whether or not this one tool that's being used to regulate hospice, the False Claims Act, still can be used as such when, you know, this huge case that the government has invested so much time in just, you know, essentially falls apart. And so the company ends up admitting no wrongdoing, you know, should emphasize that, and pays a settlement of $1 million. and is...
To whom? To the federal government.
To the government, yes. And that happens in 2020. And just, I think I'm getting my dates right, but just last year, AseraCare, the company in question, gets bought by the third largest hospice and home health company in the nation for $235 million. And this was a really interesting pattern I'd seen throughout False Claims Act litigation and settlements, which is that companies who are hit with settlements, you know, of varying amounts, often end up, it doesn't have a negative effect on their profitability. They end up kind of getting wrapped up and bought by other larger companies. And it certainly raises questions, or I think gives people good reason to question whether or not this tool that we're using, this, you know, law that's supposed to hold hospices accountable, is actually serving its function.
I find myself just baffled listening to all of this kind of fraudulent behavior. And people are at their most vulnerable. On the other hand, you found a case of a 29-year-old woman, a pregnant woman who was brought into hospice. Tell us that story.
Yeah, I mean, her, you know, her name was private in these court records, but I confirmed it with the prosecutor and the doctor who was named. And this was a hospice that was in the Mississippi Delta that was signing up seemingly, you know, anyone it could. So whether whether she was lured by a marketer who just told her to sign her name, or whether she was told it was going to be free health benefits, or whether her personal information was stolen and she was signed up that way, she ends up on hospice. And it's a hospice that's discharging, which means it's letting go of patients, discharging alive. 93% of its patients alive. So that's a number that anyone, whether they know a lot about hospice or don't, if you know what hospice is supposed to do, that raises eyebrows.
And of course,
it raises eyebrows, I think, for me as a reporter, in terms of what the federal government is doing when they see those metrics. This data is not secret. The federal government has information that shows that how many patients are dying on hospice and how many patients are leaving alive because they're not, you know, dying on time. And when you get a number like 93%, that should raise questions about, you know, why isn't there more, you know, government oversight, or what is being
done?
When
you say they're not dying on time, you mean they've overstayed that 6 months, but the company has received that 6 months of Medicare funds.
Sure, or even longer. You're able to be recertified for hospice because that can be really important, because obviously you still might have less than 6 months to live, but you might outlive your prognosis. And there are many, you know, qualified and eligible patients who might stay on hospice for a year or a year and a half instead of 6 months. But when you're a CMS inspector and looking at the numbers and you're seeing that some of these patients are in their 40s, in their 50s, 29 years old, that raises, you know, really obvious questions about who exactly is being signed up. And so a hospice might have some amount of live discharges or some amount of patients who are living, you know, far past their prognosis, and everyone expects that. And that is just part of the inherent uncertainty of sickness and illness. But when you're getting numbers in the 90%, it's shocking.
Ava, are the people who are being signed up to these less than truthful, quote, hospices, are more of them in certain regions of the country, are more of them poor, are more of them people of color, are more of them less well educated?
So there aren't great numbers on this because no one, you know, the government isn't, you know, studying this on a large scale. But what I've seen from reading the lawsuits where hospice companies are being accused of signing up ineligible patients is that the nurses and marketers in those lawsuits and the whistleblowers I've spoken to who've been trying to ferret out these practices for the last two decades, all of them told me that, you know, often the patients that they are targeting are patients who they're duping in some way because they are more vulnerable. So maybe they have, maybe they live in poverty. And so, you know, the idea of having free nutritional supplements is, you know, really appealing. Or, you know, obviously having your copay covered for medication, whether or not you need hospice is important. And I think it's, you know, important to recognize that, you know, some of the people who are signed up for hospice and don't need it do appreciate the extra help and the freebies and the benefits that they're getting. And it does speak to a deeper lack in, you know, social services in this country that, you know, we are using hospice in a as a stand-in for other, you know, social welfare mm-hmm. programs. And I think that, you know, those people who are getting these extra services, you know, it's a, you know, that can end up being a win-win, as dark as that sounds. In other cases, obviously, as we've discussed, they don't realize that they're trading away this access to curative care. And so while it can be, you know, beneficial to some people, in other cases, if you're, you know, a poor senior and you think you were just getting housekeeping, that might go really well for a couple weeks. But when it comes time to get your cataract surgery, you know, that's going to be denied. And so...
And then get thrown off hospice care when you're no longer profitable for that company.
So, and then you might be losing, you become a kind of less appealing hospice client in the future because you've used up your first benefit period, which is a whole nother kind of odd financial rabbit hole of all this. But there's plenty of evidence showing that hospices are targeting people who are demographically, you know, most vulnerable, some of the oldest and poorest and sickest Americans who, you know, may or may not need care, and those needs may be, you know, different than what hospice care, you know, ultimately is intended to provide.
Do you see more action on a federal level coming?
I'm not sure. I think the most likely action might happen at the state level, where we're seeing this kind of rampant proliferation of hospice licenses, and certain states have put in moratoria to just slow down the wave. So we've seen a moratoria in Mississippi, we've seen a moratoria in California, and so these moratoria might, you know, help at the very least keep out providers who are just trying to cash in on the kind of, you know, gold rush and bonanza and the really scam and scheming side that we've discussed.
Abe, before we close, is there anything else you'd like to tell our listeners?
I think I'd just like to emphasize that, you know, this is such a vital service. And, you know, when it's done right, it's makes a huge difference in the lives of patients, but also in the lives of their families, who often develop really close relationships with the devoted hospice workers who are, you know, coming by and helping out and lending a hand. And even some of the families I spoke to who, you know, weren't getting what their hospice, you know, was supposed to give them, they all went out of their way to emphasize that the nurses themselves were really wonderful. And, you know, we're also trying to kind of fight against some of the corner cutting that was happening at their companies. And so I think just, you know, underscoring that doing the research and finding the best program and, you know, staying as aware as possible as one can during what is, you know, obviously a really stressful time is important. And hopefully that awareness will lead to more vigilance and scrutiny so that hospice can live up to its mission and to its promise.
Ava, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Ava Kaufman of ProPublica. Her story, Endgame, appears in the December 5th issue of The New Yorker. Or you can find it online with the title, How Hospice Became a For-Profit Hustle. And that's all for today. We welcome your feedback and suggestions. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Allison Brody. Our engineer today is Adrian Danhauser. Thanks for listening, all. I'll see you next week. I'm Diane Raines.